Hello. Fred Kuhn interviews our next guest expert. And now, here's Fred.
My guest today is Susan Savitt and Lisa Barrington. And what a team. This is a legal question. It's tough, and I'm sure you, Susan, have many examples of this. So let me ask the question. If my company or any mid-cap to large company has a mandatory binding arbitration agreement policy so that when employees come in, they're required to sign as part of the application or acceptance process, what happens there? And are they really bound to it? Are there exceptions to it? Tell me about the importance of this area.
Generally, if you have a meeting of the minds and both sides know what they've signed, you will have a binding contract. But different courts, again, have interpreted differently. The federal courts are more inclined to send things to a binding arbitration situation. The state courts, for some reason, are less willing to do that. So it may, again, depend on your jurisdiction. What the binding arbitration thing does is really take the person out of court. You go to an arbitration. There's less discovery. There's less time. There's usually no appeal. So you've given up a lot of rights if you signed a binding arbitration agreement for employment issues. The EOC, however, has said that we are not going to be bound by that agreement. That case has been litigated. And what the situation is currently is that even if the employee gave its rights up, the EOC can take up that same issue, the same charge, bring the case to court by the EOC being the plaintiff. So the case will say EEOC versus XYZ company, and they can ask for specific relief for the employee who came to them to begin with. So the person can file a charge, they can't pursue the charge, but the EOC can take up the charge and run with it. Again, arbitration is going to take away a lot of rights to discovery, going to take away rights to an appeal. You're going to be in front of an individual who very often shows up over and over again. So the corporate attorneys are going to be familiar with that arbitrator as opposed to the individual. So while it's going to be cheaper, it's going to take less time. The individuals very often don't want to go down that road.
So what happens, just from a point of view of the human side of this, Susan? I come into the company, they want me to sign. Am I required to sign this mandatory arbitration binding agreement?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and it might depend on whether there's a union involved or what the state is saying about it. But probably you're not going to keep your job if you don't sign it.
Or they won't offer you one. Right.
That's right.
Can they make you sign one of these after you're already employed, or is this a precondition of employment?
It's done both ways, so that if you change a condition of employment, very often you have to have some benefit involved. Let's assume you give them a new title, you give them a raise, you give them a new location, a new desk, something like that, and you might change the terms and conditions of employment at that point and then put the thing into effect.
So, Susan, what happens if after the fact they put a policy in place and they say, for all current employees, you are now, as a condition of employment, and we're an at-will employer, you are now subject to this policy, and, of course, going forward, all new hires will be subject. What happens to the current employees if there's no benefit offered in exchange and they don't sign the agreement?
Well, the benefit is that you continue your employment. So, essentially, you can force them to abide by it even if they haven't signed it. And let's assume it's a published policy and you're given the right to stay or not stay. If you agree to stay under these new rules and regulations, then you basically have accepted the policy.
It's an implied acceptance.
It's implied, but it's also, the benefit is your job. Courts may not agree with me always, but there's a good chance that that arbitration agreement is going to be in effect.
As I understand it, Susan, you won a lot of cases.
I have, but I'm not always right.
Oh, so, Fred,
I would add from a HR perspective, here's the thing. Arbitration agreements and binding arbitration agreement policies are put in place by companies because it benefits the company. It's just that simple. It generally is not going to offer as much benefit to the employee because it removes some of those employees' rights. And it gives the employers more control and less cost in case there is an action. And that's the bottom line. And employees certainly can refuse to sign it, or, for instance, someone could refuse to sign it upon a job offer. And I will tell you, even though most companies, if it's part of the policy, will then withdraw the offer, occasionally they'll make an exception for employees that are difficult, hard to fill positions, or have unique skill sets, and they will make an exception on occasion. I've seen that happen.
It could be, and basically what you're doing is setting up an employment contract that's different from everybody else. So you're setting up a different employment situation with that
individual. Isn't that discrimination against all the others who don't have that exception?
Well, I suppose if the person you gave the exception to and everybody else in the company is a female, that might be a case, but I don't think it would be looked at that way normally. Right. I'm sure you are aware of non-compete agreements, and it's kind of looked at the same way, that different people might have different situations.
That's another whole subject, isn't it? Non-compete agreements.
I think it's almost worse.
Well, is there anything else that we can contribute so the listeners have a really good picture here on binding arbitration and the do's and don'ts?
You know, I think the only thing, and I did allude to it before, is if there is a labor group involved, you know, a union or something else, that a lot of these answers may be different.
Are there any questions, final comments that you'd like to make in closing?
I do have a couple of things I think that people should be aware of. I'm not sure if people recognize the prevalence of sexual harassment in the United States. For example, a recent ABC News poll found that half of American women reported that they've experienced unwanted sexual advancements at work. Half. That's 50% of them. And a quarter of them said that these advances were from someone who had influence over them at work. And I think what's also important to understand is that this can lead to charges. And the EEOC in 2017 filed 184 lawsuits alleging discrimination. And that's out of tens of thousands of claims. So they only pick the ones that they think have merit. And you should know, and our audience should know, that the EEOC achieved a successful outcome in 91% of all of their filings. So if they file, they have pretty good evidence. So that's over 150 of those lawsuits where people, organizations, were found guilty of discrimination. And it could be as simple as they just have to rehire that person and give them back wages, but it could be much more complex, including class actions, which many of those were, by the way, about 30, or it could also include punitive damages, which could be quite high.
The only thing I would add, Fred, is that regardless of the size of the employer, there is some law somewhere that is applicable to them in this area. And especially now when the mores seem to be in a great state of flux and change, people are becoming more and more aware of this issue. And although it's been around for many years now, the Me Too movement, all the rest, is making people more aware of the fact that they might have rights. But that does not mean that you can't just have a convivial employee workplace. I don't think it has to be everybody scared of everybody else. If you just learn what you're supposed to do, act appropriately, and have the proper procedures in place, everything should run just fine.
Like my dad used to say, do the right thing.
That's correct.
You know, and we spend a lifetime trying to figure out what that is, but it's still a good philosophy. Do the right thing. It's so important, I think, to do that, whether you're a large company or a small company. Doing the right thing supersedes any of that. That's my opinion. But you all are the experts.
And I think communication and knowing the law are also
Yes,
very important.
I would agree. Having been through this series now with the both of you, I would say that understanding of the ignorance of the law is no excuse. Well, I'd like to thank Lisa Barrington and Susan Savitt, contributors to this section of Women in the Workplace. It's been a delightful series. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for visiting with us. We welcome your comments and suggestions and look forward to having you join us soon at Workplace Strategies.